Radcliffe Chambers. Before calling the members to ask a question, I would like to remind all members that questions should be limited to matters within the scope of the bill and that we must stick rigidly to the timings in the programme motion that the committee has already agreed. For this panel, we have until midday. Could, to begin with, the two witnesses, for the record, briefly introduce themselves?
Jonathan Turner, Chief Executive of the organisation UK Lawyers for Israel, and a barrister.
And I'm Stephen Barrett, and I'm a barrister. I write sometimes in the press on law, and I occasionally appear in the media on law.
Thank you very much. Could I have some indication of questions? Minister?
Before we begin, transparency. I don't think there's a fully declarable interest. For the sake of transparency, just say Stephen Barrett is known to me as a councillor in Buckinghamshire.
Thank you.
Yes, for the sake of transparency, I'm a
Conservative councillor in Buckinghamshire Unity Authority, which I will not form part of any of the evidence I give to this committee. I'm a parish councillor in Chepping Wickham, but that's not party affiliated.
Very busy man.
It kind of needs to say.
Minister.
Thank you, Chair. As we know, this bill does not in any way change the UK's foreign policy approach to the Middle East. Would you agree that this bill is in line with government's obligations under international law?
Yes, I would.
I'd also go further to say that it has the beneficial effect of securing the UK's compliance with international law, particularly with World Trade Organization agreements, which do impose restrictions on the UK central government and a very wide range of public bodies. This bill and the enforcement of this bill will ensure that activities of decisions of public authorities, of subordinate public authorities, will not put the UK in breach of particularly the government procurement agreement, which is part of the World Trade Organization collection of agreements.
Yes, although I hesitate to reply on that, because complying with international law is a political position. So what I'd like to make clear to this committee is perhaps to explain our constitution and how we work. It's really important that this is understood. It was clarified recently by the Supreme Court, so we are back to now understanding the constitution, and we have a unique relationship with international law. If you wanted, we could all go to the British Museum and look at some 2,500-year-old international law. That's how, it's older than that. There's great, great masses of it. Absolutely no legal jurisdiction in the world makes all of it binding upon that jurisdiction. So if you take an EC, a European-style constitution after the war, that they will use a constitutional court to choose which bits of international law they want and don't want. And they make it the job of their judges and their courts to do that. And when we were in some constitutional confusion after coming out of the EU, I did wonder if that's the system that we would use. But quite clearly what happened then is, if you all remember the Northern Ireland case about the impacts on the Acts of Union by the protocol, they went to the courts, and the courts very clearly said, no, this is not for us. So we are clear, we do not have a continental style system where a court can break international law or exit it for us. What we have is a system where you deal with it. And this parliament deals with international law, and we draw a line we call incorporation. So incorporated international law is binding upon us. If you all remember Miller 1 and the fuss the government had where it was pretending that it could get out of the EU without passing an act, no, because that part of international law that made up the EU, that was incorporated international law. And so to get rid of incorporated international law, they had to use an act of parliament. If it was unincorporated, then that would be entirely different. And that is the line that we draw. It's a really important one that people start remembering it. We haven't sort of needed to know about it since the 60s. So in his speech when he clarified this, Lord Reed, who's the president of the Supreme Court, was very forgiving. He just calls it a misunderstanding that has arisen. I like to say a confusion, because nobody should feel guilty about this. This is sort of constitution, bits of the Constitution we haven't had to wield for decades. So how anybody was supposed to sort of instantaneously know that when we left the EU, this is what would happen. But that is what happens. And it is the role of Parliament, not government, Parliament, to control the operation of international law. You do that through Acts of Parliament. So this proposed bill, of course it's lawful, of course it is, because it's simply a mechanism for doing that. And in his most recent note, I note Mr. Herman concedes that. The only relevant part, sorry, if I can just get this out, the only relevant part that come out of a lawyer's lips are whether you can or can't do something. Whether you should or shouldn't is entirely for you. And so he says you can, and that I think is enough from any lawyer.
Can I just...
Why don't you bring other members of the committee in? If there is time at the end, I'll bring the minister back.
I do have a quick segue into
very the quick, then.
So today we will be hearing from Richard Hermer, KC, who's provided legal advice to the Labour Party. Can you just quickly give your views on that advice? Can I turn to Jonathan, since Stephen has already addressed that?
Yes. Most of his advice, I think, is wrong, and I've set out reasons why his opinion that was published and circulated at the time of the second reading. I've given detailed reasons as to why that's wrong, but I would just like to take the opportunity now to address the note that he sent round last night, because I'm afraid to say it's still wrong. So one of the points that he made before was he claims that this bill would affect a profound change in the autonomy of local government. That is just not correct. There are existing very substantial restraints on the autonomy of local government when it comes to procurement and when it comes to investment. Some of those will be replaced by this bill. Some of those will continue, but it is simply not the case that this makes a sudden and enormous change. Now, he's accepted that Section 17 of the Local Government Act 1988 affected a substantial restriction on local government bodies, but he's ignored, and even though I've sent him two emails pointing this out, he's ignored the EU legislation which affected a very substantial restriction. And then he goes on to say, well, the Local Government Act only applied to local government bodies, not to other public authorities, but the EU legislation applies to a very broad range of public authorities. Now, the regulations implementing the EU directives as far as England, Wales and Northern Ireland are to be repealed by the procurement bill, which is in its final stages. It doesn't affect the regulations implementing the EU directives in Scotland, so that will apparently continue in force. And the memorandum the Scottish Government to the Scottish Parliament suggests that that will continue to be the case. But the position is that this bill effectively replaces that EU legislation as far as England, Wales and Northern Ireland is concerned within its terms, within its in relation to territorial matters. Really, what this bill does is it the most important aspect of this bill is to transfer a matter that was regulated by EU law into a matter that's regulated by national law, and to set out the national law governing this particular matter. And so it is part of the Brexit agenda of, if you like, taking back control. You may agree or disagree with the decision that the British people made, but it was made. This bill, part of the function of this bill, a major part of the function of this bill, is actually to replace existing pre-existing EU-based legislation with UK-based legislation, together with the procurement bill.
Thank you. Sorry.
A point of order,
I hope it is a point of order.
Well, I hope so too. I just want to ask your advice. Is it appropriate for a witness to this committee to give evidence in the form of attacking another witness who has not got the opportunity to respond to his comments because he's not here? Surely a witness should be given positive remarks about why something should be done rather than criticise another witness.
Interesting point, but it isn't a point of order for the chair. It is in the hands of the witnesses themselves to give their evidence in the way that they think most appropriate. And if that involves commenting on evidence we've already heard, then it's certainly acceptable for them to do so. You might not like it,
but I don't think many people
the system. I'm going to move swiftly on now. We've got a number of people who've indicated they want to take part, so I'm going to move to Alex Norris.
The key test in Clause 1 about the actions of a decision-maker is whether it would cause a reasonable observer of the decision-making process to conclude that the decision was influenced by political or moral disapproval. Are you content with the phrase reasonable observer? Do you think that's tight enough? Could it be clearer? Question for both of you, please.
Yeah. So, reasonable observer, reasonable person, is used throughout English law and Welsh law and so on. It's the basis of the law of negligence. You interpret contracts by reference to how they're understood by the reasonable person, legislation similarly, and lots of other documents. It provides an objective test instead of looking at the subjective intention of a maker of a statement, and that has the benefit of greater certainty, greater clarity. And that's why it is used, and I'm very happy with this being the formulation that's used. I think I don't think there's any problem with it at all. I think it's the best way of doing it. You would have terrible difficulties if you tried to do things in terms of what the subjective intention of the people adopting the rule decision is.
So just to follow up on that then, we can have confidence in it as essentially as a term of art that will be easily understood by the court and is not likely to lead to a series of cases based on whether or not one is reasonable or not. Is that likely to be tested?
It's not likely to be tested, right, because that is quite a settled test. Right. So it's a legal mechanism for taking subjectivity and turning it into objectivity, which is what law does, which is why when I speak on public on law, I have the unique and remarkable opportunity to annoy everyone. So it is an acceptable test, and I wouldn't worry about it. The courts are familiar with it.
There's time at the end, but I have a number of people who've indicated they want to. Dr. Luke Evans.
Thank you, Chair. Much has been discussed with other witnesses about the need of Clause 4. This is a question to Jonathan Turner. Do you agree that Clause 4 is necessary in the bill, and do you think it's compatible with Article 10 of the ECHR?
Well, I think certainly parts of it are necessary because otherwise you have the Leicester City Council type approach of saying we're supporting boycotts, we want goods from a particular territory to be boycotted as far as the law allows. And that's deeply problematic because first of all, it has the same impact on community cohesion as any other BDS measure that targets a particular country and indirectly targets a particular ethnicity. And secondly, it creates a degree of confusion and difficulty for the staff who have to implement it. They've got to work out what the law does allow in terms of boycotting, and so they've then got to go to they've got to find out what the facts are, they've got to go to the lawyers, there'll be argument about all of that, and the whole thing becomes a mess and discourages them from accepting certain tenders. And what's more, they're further discouraged by the fact that they might offend some of the councillors who were so vehement in passing the measure. So it does actually have this chilling effect on the public authority that and the staff of the public authority that are then left with dealing with it. So that I see as the primary target of this provision. As to whether it conflicts with human rights requirements, no, it doesn't, because public authorities, and it only binds public authorities, doesn't stop individual members saying, I support BDS, I don't like what such and such a state is doing. It doesn't stop individual members saying that. It only stops a public authority saying that. And public authorities, we know from the House of Lords decision in the Aston Cantlow case, public authorities do not have human rights, at any rate, under the European Convention on Human Rights and the Human Rights Act. I think that's why they've chosen to do this by reference to Section 6 of the Human Rights Act as the definition of public authority.
Mr. Byron, is there anything you want to add to that briefly?
No, because I can't answer the necessary question, because I think that would be a personal political opinion. I can say it's lawful, and I agree that it would not breach Article 10.
Thank you. Chris Stevens.
Thanks, Chair. Union training tells me if you... you have two lawyers in the room and you ask them a question, you get at least three opinions, so I'm going to try anyway with one question. The Scottish Government opposes the BDS campaign but also strongly discourages trade with companies active in the occupied Palestinian territories, an occupation which is recognised as illegal under international law and by the UK Government. So how would you both respond to the concerns that people have around the bill that effectively condones what many would regard as illegal occupation?
First of all, I don't accept that it's an illegal occupation. Many international lawyers will say that the settlements are illegal, this is based on Article 49.6 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits an occupying power, transferring part of its population into occupied territory. But conducting a business is not transferring population. And it's not just me that says this. The Supreme Court said this in Richardson against DPP. They said conducting a business in the West Bank does not make the operator of the factory, the private operator of the factory, doesn't make it a person that is promoting the transfer by the state of people into occupied territory, because you running a business is not transferring people. So the suggestion, it's sloppy thinking to say that the settlements are illegal, therefore companies operating in the vicinity of settlements, and they don't normally operate actually in residential areas anyway. They normally operate in trading estates outside of the residential areas. It's sloppy thinking to say that this means that operating the factory or selling the goods or buying the goods are illegal under international law. They're not.
All I'd say is that it is a personal political opinion, what you think about the situation in the Middle East. As law, it's important that we get back to a healthy relationship with international law, which is understanding the role of incorporation and your role in controlling the flow of international law into this jurisdiction. When he corrected this for us lawyers, for us presumably to pass on to people like you, the President of the Supreme Court speculated it might be that because we're so used to the EU, so for 40 years, EU law has been supreme here. That means that it's been in charge. And that means that ministers could be told, no minister, that policy is illegal. No minister, you cannot do this. No minister. And that has been going on for so long that many of us, simply by a form of muscle memory or attachment to that, are used to groping for some legal reason not to do things. Now the EU has gone, international law has never been supreme. It's not supreme anywhere, and it's certainly never been supreme here. And so you need, all of you collectively, to come to terms with the power and responsibility you have And if you think something about the situation in the Middle East, if you think something else about the situation in the Middle East, you must sort it out. We'll use democracy as a mechanism for you know, settling the issues and seeing what the voters think. But that's the system that we have, and it's very important that we operate in it. So this groping around, and I note, because really the only important part of Mr. Herman's statement, the one I saw this morning, is where he says you can do this. That honestly, that is all you need to know. But groping around for just a resolution of the UN, which sounds pretty weak sort of source of international law anyway, and then looking at its wording and trying to say that means you can't pass an act of Parliament here. No, that's constitutionally eccentric. And actually, if somebody will allow me, I do have drafting concerns with the bill. I don't know if we'll get to those, but I would like to raise it if I can.
We're running rapidly out of time. I've got the opportunity for one very quick question. Anna Quasar.
Thank you. It was just you said that you had in the drafting of the bill.
Yes.
Can you explain them, please?
Yes. Mr. Herman actually flags them himself, and he's right. Paragraph 6 of Schedule 1 is a constitutionally unique event. We have, given everything I've said and explained to you here, we have never recognised all international law as binding. My reading of that paragraph seems to me that extraordinary statement. So if you don't amend that, and I seriously suggest it is well, I would just get rid of it, to be honest, because it is giving supremacy to international law. It is conceding the power that the voters gave you and giving it to this great, great mass, which is thousands of years old, and people will be able to reach into this great mass that is international law and pluck out everything. You probably pluck out bits that contradict the other bits. You know, but they'll be able to pluck into it and draw out something to justify a boycott of whichever boycott they want. The people who are motivated to do boycotts are very strongly motivated to do them. They will use that paragraph, and if you'll allow me, I also think they will use the preceding paragraph 4. Which is the finance one. The finance one's just a bit woolly. I think it could be tightened up. I'd be very happy to help with drafting. I might write a note after this if it assists anybody. I'm always happy to help governments of any colour. Should the government change, I will be happy to help on law only. But I wanted to raise those two issues. 6 in particular is really a constitutional aberration. It's giving away your sovereignty to a great amorphous entity that's not properly controlled. At least the EU had structures and was under a control. The EU is like, if you think of international law like a territory, it's carved out a space for itself and it's stable. The rest of international law is not stable.
Thank you. Can I, on behalf of the committee, thank the witnesses. It's been quite a probing experience, I'm sure, for the witnesses, but I think even if we might not agree, individuals might not agree with the advice you've given, I think they respect the fact that it was given in good faith and from a base of knowledge that is very helpful. So thank you very much.
Thank you.